everyone, and welcome back to Literary Loitering. We are the Geek Show's dedicated podcast to all things books, arts, and things not related to books and arts at all, because we don't stay on topic at all.
He ain't wrong.
I'm Andrew, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Rob and Graham, except for those weeks when sometimes one of them isn't here.
He's still not wrong. This is remarkable. Two facts in a row.
Yeah, that cake I had yesterday was very good as well.
That cake I had yesterday was also very good. Because I assume it was the same cake, but a different slice.
No.
I also have enjoyed cake.
See, you two had the same cake. I had a different cake.
What was your cake?
Not as good as the one that I got for you two.
Oh, that's nice.
Although it was still very good.
We can't keep the listeners listening to this blazingly exciting cake discussion forever, right?
As exciting as it is listening to Graham eat a slice of chocolate fudge cake and then regurgitate it back into my mouth. Book news.
Hang on. Since when did Graham become a mother bird?
Since we probably ate the same cake. That's the punchline I was getting to. Bam! Show. It's a comedy podcast.
Anyway. Yes. Which has difficulty staying on topic, as you said, Andrew.
And then demonstrated.
Yeah. Big news, everyone.
Ooh.
Discworld's getting a TV series.
Excellent.
Or rather, not the Discworld itself. You know the watch? The Ankh-Morpork watch, headed by old Stoneface himself? It's getting a TV series based on them. And
right.
What I'm imagining, as soon as I saw the headline, this is without going into the article itself, but just from the headline, it said, City Watch is getting a TV adaptation. I'm like, I don't remember a book called City Watch. I remember there was a book called The Watch, and it was kind of like a slightly more serious and sinister, but also very comedic version of The Thin Blue Line, you know, the Rowan Atkinson one.
Yeah.
And so that's basically what I'm imagining this is going to end up as, a kind of Discworld version of that.
Yeah, I can see it.
Which I think could work.
Not
or,
the first.
Or even better, it's going to be British Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Oh, yes.
And that could be very good indeed.
Or it's going to be that Netflix film about orc cops, but this time with intentional humour.
Oh, is it going to be like Top Coppers?
Maybe. That's a deep cut, though.
Yes.
It's a little bit of BBC Three before it became entirely digital, was that?
But possibly even the last good thing BBC Three did.
Yeah, I've liked some of the documentary stuff, particularly since they went online. It's like they had to have the complete closure of their station as a terrestrial TV channel before they thought,
yeah,
maybe better produce some good content at some point.
But yeah. Probably just now that they're not paying that studio, they can afford a camera.
Possibly. I want to nominate somebody for the lead role in this instead of Sam Vimes, because I feel he's got too much exposure from the books.
Hmm.
I want to nominate Cecil Wormsborough St. John Nobbs.
Are you sure he's not going to be too busy leading the Conservative Party?
He does sound like that, but the person I'm nominating is actually Nobby Nobbs, who apparently is not just hunchback, but also hunch sideways and hunch front as well.
Right.
I mean, I guess that brings up my main concern, which is, who are you going to get to play these people?
Is it definitely going to be live action?
Well, BBC Studios have confirmed that the show is in development. They haven't said whether it's going to be live action yet, but it is definitely going to be the Ankh-Morpork Police Department. There are various bodies involved that suggest it is going to be live action.
Right.
And it's going to be 6 one-hour episodes.
Yeah.
Has the BBC ever done anything animated?
Yeah.
Very, very little. I mean, outside of children's programming, very little.
You got me there.
Yeah, I meant outside of children's TV.
I was going to name all those kids' cartoons as well.
But yeah, this is quite promising, isn't it? And it's coming around the same time as Good Omens seems to be chugging along nicely in production, doesn't it?
And it's coming on the back of Neil Gaiman writing more Sandman as well.
So. Oh, right. I didn't know that was happening.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's like a Sandman universe.
I was briefly excited, and then when you described it as a universe, I got not excited.
No, it's going to be the Sandman cinematic universe, Graham.
Yeah, but then again, because it's Sandman, he literally could make a universe out of it, because they are basically cosmic beings, aren't they?
You're not wrong there.
I just realised that I wanted death at the end of this movie, and then I realised that's not going to happen, and now I've made myself sad with my own joke.
The sheer amount of failed attempts to bring Sandman to the big screen is probably worthy of a book of its own right now.
Probably. I would love to see a good Sandman movie. But then again, Sandman might actually work better as a TV series.
Yeah, I would think so. DC's announcement of the DC Cinematic Universe said that Joseph Gordon-Levitt would be producing and starring in a Sandman movie that would be out by winter 2016. But try and contain your surprise that an announcement made by DC Films did not actually work out as planned.
I'm
not surprised that that existed, because I now realise I'd completely scrubbed that from my mind.
It's just you erasing the disappointment of it not happening, rather than DC attempting to erase Henry Cavill's moustache and spending however many millions on it, and then somebody came along with a £300 computer and did a much better job.
I mean, to be fair to them, which I think I've said before, I think that the bad CGI, that was more of a case of, we've got a month to do this.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, apparently this guy did it in about an afternoon.
Oh, Jesus, DC / Warner Brothers.
This is the thing, I read the article about it on one of those tech websites, and they were like, yeah, this guy did it in an afternoon on a £300 computer, and it cost DC several million to do it professionally. And he still did a better job.
Worth every penny, though. I mean, every movie has to budget for digital tash removal.
Is that the new feminine beauty product?
Did you hear what Call Me By Your Name, what one of this year's Oscar contenders, had to do in post-production?
No.
If you've seen stills of Call Me By Your Name, you'll know that it's set during a very hot Italian summer, and everyone is, as one review I read on Letterboxd said, dressed like they're going to their first Vampire Weekend concert, which means a lot of tennis gear. And in post-production, they found out that tennis was an appropriate phrase, as Armie Hammer seemed to be smuggling some balls that were overly distracting.
Oh, yeah, I heard about this. This is that film about the peaches, isn't it?
yes, it is. The peach could stay, but the plums could not.
Can we call this episode that?
That was someone's job.
Not mine, tragically.
There was an entire committee dedicated purely to how much of Armie Hammer's giant hanging man fruits allowed to show before we need another rating upgrade. It's like a diagram, like bands, where it's like, okay, so as you can see, extending past this point, it moves from a 15 to an 18, so just shave off a couple of inches if you could.
And so what happens if there's an overlapping diagram, so it's a Venn diagram of two circles together?
But what if the software picked that up?
This is our first story.
Yeah, how?
This is our first story, which consists of, there's maybe going to be a Discworld Watch TV series, which sounds pretty good. That was the entirety of the story. 15 minutes.
Anyway, Graham, what else has been happening?
Should we move on to some old hair?
Yes.
Can't see anything that could be unintentionally homoerotic here, but let's have a look and see. A researcher at the Schaefer Library in New York has discovered what is believed to be a lock of George Washington's hair inside an 18th century almanac. The strands are thought to have been given to the book's owner by the son of Alexander Hamilton, the famous rapper. Within the covers of the book, which is believed to have belonged to Philip Schuyler, son of one of Union College's founders, General Philip Schuyler, he discovered a series of Schuyler's handwritten notes on topics included... All right, okay, it's gone downhill already. Notes on topics including how to preserve beef for summer's use. Yes.
Andrew, I'll let you comment on that.
I can't. I can't get past the 18th century gentleman sitting around saying, ah, summer has arrived. Time to get out the preserved beef.
Yes, time to unlock the beef closet.
I didn't know.
The army hammer. Take it out your tennis shorts.
Oh, another episode title. Unlock the beef closet.
I think that wins for me because it's more disgusting.
And you can make it more seasonal saying, unlock the summer beef closet.
It's the for summer use that gets me.
It's true. Is it like some sort of upper class etiquette thing? Where it's like, oh dear, I see the Wilsons have used winter beef in July.
Wasn't there an Old Saints song or something like that called Winter in July?
Ah, Bomb the Base, that was.
Was it?
Yeah,
Bomb the Base. Yeah.
Maybe that was what they were singing about. That they'd been to a party and someone had brought out winter's range of beef. Oh dear, it's like winter in July here.
Oh wow.
Wait a minute, that's a viable dance pop record.
Quickly, must alight to our carriages at once and return to the studio.
I always thought Bomb the Base were, you know, spotting those powdered wigs very fashionably.
Yes, they were impressive. They have a literary connection, you know, Bomb the Base.
Yeah.
Their excellent song, Bug Powder Dust, features Justin Warfield basically rapping a plot summary of William S. Burroughs' Naked Lunch.
Okay.
That was a series of words you put together into a sentence.
Exactly. That's strange and ever so slightly, no, ever so greatly disturbing.
Yeah, worth YouTubing that. It's very good indeed.
Completely unrelated to strange and disturbing things. Let's go back to people stealing lots of George Washington's hair to put in books.
Yeah, I mean,
you have to question it, don't you?
Well, wasn't it the thing where you used to put a lock of your loved one's hair in a locket?
Yeah.
So is this kind of a weird fetishist upscaling of that?
It's quite odd that Hamilton would do that to George Washington. I mean, I realise things have changed a bit now with people like Mickey Blanco and Frank Ocean, but back then hip-hop was a very homophobic subculture.
Yeah, not only that, I mean, how does he know it was actually George Washington's hair? Weren't powdered wigs in fashion around the time of George Washington?
Yeah. Did he go in when Washington was sleeping?
What if it was the other way around? What if George Washington just came to him one day and said, hey, mind if I borrow your almanac? And then a week later he brought it back. And there's just like strands of hair stuck to pages.
Maybe.
Don't
ask.
Yeah, I was about to say, are you saying Hamilton just looks at him weirdly and goes, why is it like this?
Washington was
then
molting.
Kind of song and dance routine. I don't know all these references. Oh. If there's one thing I'm very, very excited about, it's my general apathy towards Hamilton.
Yeah.
It's something that you've cultivated carefully, isn't it? It's quite impressive.
It is, through years and years of deliberately not watching the musical.
Was that mainly because the musical was only available in America until recently?
Predominantly, yes.
And you have to remortgage your house to get a ticket.
Yeah.
That was also a large contributing factor.
Anyway, shall we move on?
Please.
Right. You know, 5-year-olds.
Oh, well, I mean, not sort of closely, but I'm aware of the concept.
Yeah, I think I've met one or two.
Yeah, 5-year-olds generally aren't noted for writing books in general. Maybe telling the odd story here and there, but not exactly for writing books, yeah?
Hmm.
And also, if they are going to tell a story, it's usually some weird, outlandish type thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. 5-year-old Kennedy O'Neill, which sounds like a dude but actually is a little girl, her morning routine is to eat breakfast at the counter in her kitchen while she counts the change and small bits in the glass jar she uses as a piggy bank. And she has written a book with her dad on saving and investing because she's apparently been doing it since she was very, very little.
So yesterday.
I've often said, and I think we all have, that what the world desperately needs more of is economists. So this is great news.
Yeah. She has apparently amassed almost $60, which is an earth-shattering amount. And her book, which is going to be self-published, is called The Adventures of Super Kennedy, Saving and Investing. Now, I'm guessing this is a book aimed at other children to help them and encourage them to save money, which is always a good thing.
But what's she investing it in? I mean, if it's Bitcoin, it could be, like, worth nothing by now.
See, that's the bit that confuses me, right? Saving, yes, all for it. But a 5-year-old should not really be doing stocks and shares now, should she?
No.
I mean, it's a very complicated business. I mean, I used to work in investment banking. I still don't know how the Dow Jones works.
Secretly, I don't think anyone does.
I just know that some things go up, some things go down, some people make money, some people lose money. It's all a bit of a gamble, you know? Let's roll the dice.
Just all the things they're yelling in the stock market are actually coded messages saying, please, oh God, help, I've no idea what I'm doing.
You know the Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd movie, Trading Places? You know all those scenes in the stock exchange? I understood about 1/6 of the language they were using, partly because it was old stocks and shares jargon, which nobody uses anymore, and partly because, you know, I used to work in investment banking, so I had some vague idea, but I was well away from like the shop floor, so to speak. So I'm just sitting here going, well, I know that in order to buy shares, don't you have to be 18?
Yeah. I mean, is her dad like a front?
Is this a money laundering thing?
Does her dad have to go in every morning and go, oh God, I'm going to have to put an accumulator stock on lollipops again?
Can you imagine, though, if her dad comes down and she's just sitting there reading the Financial Times? A newspaper that's actually bigger than she is.
Yes.
I think the important thing is she's got the key point of being an economist down pat, in that she tells other people how to use their money despite having no financial responsibilities of her own.
Now that we've destroyed the academic discipline of economics forever, I mean, I hate to be overambitious, but we have, haven't we?
Finally brought down this capitalist hell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should we have some news about the benefits of culture?
Go on then. What are the benefits of culture?
Here is an excerpt from a talk that is being given by David Byrne, the former lead singer of Talking Heads, who has been collecting reasons to be optimistic in the current climate for a few years now. He says, we in the arts and humanities often complain that our work is undervalued, at least in terms of being beneficial to society compared to the STEM disciplines. Finally, we have some proof, and the effects are somewhat unexpected. A recent study by the Social Impact of the Arts Project at the University of Pennsylvania showed that when libraries and other cultural institutions are placed in the boroughs around New York, there are 4 surprising knock-on effects. One, which I think is foreseeable is that the kids' test scores go up.
Yeah, I can maybe see a correlation between those two.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Two, though, spousal abuse goes down.
Okay, that one I could see the correlation to as well, because a lot of the time violence comes around because of ignorance.
Yes. Three, though, and this is quite an odd one, obesity goes down.
That's a lie.
You're calling David Byrne. David Byrne, the man who wrote Life During Wartime, calling him a liar.
Well, I wouldn't say he's a liar. I'd say he might be a little bit misinformed, because if doing things like reading books could make you thin, I would be a stick.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is, imagine how much you'd weigh if you didn't read.
I'd have my own gravitational field.
The final answer, which I think is most exciting, because it means that librarians are basically superheroes now,
okay,
is that the crime rate goes down.
Yeah, there are two ways of looking at that. See,
well, obviously, it's what happens is the burglars break into the area, look around and go, oh, it's just a load of books, who cares, and leave again.
Yeah, but then they go and break into someone else's house and then find it's just a load of books, and then try the next house and it's just a load of books. And so the crime rate technically goes up. See, I keep remembering that one story of the young teenage boy in, I think it was Dorset, several years ago, and they arrested him and eventually put him into a youth institute. And once they took him off the street, the crime rate across the county dropped by 85%.
God.
Right. And
I said the library is like locking up criminals.
No, I'm saying that, you know,
had book thoughts.
I'm playing devil's advocate here. I'm saying there may be an alternative reason as to the high crime rate. So maybe if you take those particular people who are serial criminals off the streets, maybe that could also contribute more effectively to reducing the crime rate.
Now, I think that John Byrne is saying, quite ironically, his work has led to a sharp decrease in psycho killers.
Qu'est-ce que c'est?
Whenever I'm out driving, if I have a book in my car, I will not hide it away. I will leave it out on full view, because I sort of think if a criminal is going by, then they are motivated to break into someone's car just to get a copy of Robert Musil's The Man Without Qualities. I'm not even mad.
Well, let's put it this way. I have proof, right, that the crime rate does not go down just because somebody reads books.
Yeah.
I can prove this, because this actually happened to me. I was sitting in the Southfield several years ago, and I had one of those old Nokia 3210 phones or wherever they were. I think it was a 3210 or a 3110, I can't remember. It was a brick. And I was reading a copy of Men at Arms, the Terry Pratchett Discworld novel. And so I went to the bar to get a drink. And there was only a few people in the Southfield at that point, Southfield being a pub area.
Yeah.
So I put the book down, put the phone on top of the book, went to the bar to get a drink. I came back, my phone was still there.
I think that's more just sometimes you just have to go for the highest value item.
That's my point. Just because it's a book doesn't mean it's not going to get nicked.
I mean, it's not going to get nicked when there's literally no other option.
I always find
at least you can burn the book for fuel if you're desperate.
I always find it ironic that they stole a book about fictional police force.
Yes.
So, yeah, the irony factor was there. Of course, it wasn't the first adventure that phone had been on. I mean, that phone is still around this house somewhere. It's just lurking. It's like the creature under the bed now. Anyway, leaving that to one side. Before we started recording, I asked you both a question. Who do you think has done more for literacy and reading? Is it A, Donald Trump, B, Dolly Parton, C, Mick Jagger, or D, Ronald Reagan?
Now, I think I've heard this story, so I've recused myself, but Andrew?
And I'm sure it's Mick Jagger, because of his hit songs like Remember to Work Out a Good Joke for This Bit Before the Recording Starts. Like,
Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Jesus, list of Rolling Stones songs, you're not helping.
Paint It Black, Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Sympathy for the Devil is inspired by Mikhail Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita. So there's that.
The answer...
Like the hit Rolling Stones song, Let's Spend the Night Together, brackets, reading a good book.
That's the radio edit.
It wasn't Mick Jagger. It was actually Dolly Parton.
Mm.
Yeah. See, I'm not saying that the others haven't done anything for literacy and reading, but in the case of Trump...
He has written that great novel about sexy life in Trump Tower.
Oh, he also allegedly wrote The Art of the Deal, which we know he didn't. But Dolly Parton, I was surprised to find she's given away 100 million books. And the book that she's given to kind of commemorate the fact that it's 100 million books is a special copy of Court of Many Colors. And it was donated to the Library of Congress in Washington. And she's set up a partnership with the Library of Congress to live stream story readings, which is an amazing thing to do.
Yeah.
But she also set up in 1996 the Imagination Library in Sevier County, Tennessee, where she was raised, and children whose families sign up are posted free books, which are funded via charitable giving. And the reason why she did all this is because her own father was illiterate. And her thoughts on it are, I'm going to do this to get books in the hands of children, because if you can read, you can educate yourself. Which,
good on her.
You know, I thought it's a nice feel-good story, you know.
And amongst... if David Byrne is right, it also makes her a crime fighter.
Yeah, superhero.
Yeah.
Well, good on her.
Yeah. So a nice, wholesome story for once.
I think so. It sounds like we're kind of struggling to talk about something that's nice, aren't we?
Well, I think we're confused by the lack of horrifying detail or sick perversion.
Or just the implausibility of, say, a 5-year-old doing stocks and shares.
Maybe.
Any other stories for you, Graham?
Yeah, shall we talk about a right douche?
Please, yes.
What, a cleaning product? People often forget that's also a thing.
It's true. Like, Terry Goodkind, or Terry Goodkind, we were discussing how to pronounce this guy's name before the show started, and we decided we don't care, is a fantasy author whose new book, Shroud of Eternity, is coming out soon. Now, before we get underway on this story, I just want you to take a look at the cover of Shroud of Eternity.
Okay.
Anything strike you as odd about this?
It's certainly a fairly generic-looking fantasy book.
That's basically what I thought when I saw it. It's just, you know, that's a fantasy book cover, all right. Terry Goodkind disagrees. He posted a Facebook post saying, Shroud of Eternity is a great book with a very bad cover. Laughably bad. So let's have some fun with it. Tell us what you think of the cover in my next post, the poll above, and we'll pick 10 random entries to win a signed copy of the hardcover. We'll pick the 10 winners on March the 1st. Everyone's welcome to play. Just cast your vote and post a comment. Now, as I say, it basically looks like any other fantasy book cover, and this has perplexed the artist Bastien Lecouf de Harm, who said, I am a very confident person. I have a long career, long enough for me to be able to take that. But this behaviour is just not acceptable. Goodkind has posted an apology saying, fantastically, I was sent the cover art shortly before publication. We all expressed our dissatisfaction with the character representation of the artwork and we protested the printing. We were overruled and the book went to print as is. So apparently it's everyone else's fault now, which kind of makes sense when you realise that Terry Goodkind is an objectivist.
So here's the thing though. Does this Terry Goodchild, sorry, because kid
Goodkind.
Child, so yes,
that's kind, big jokes. Yeah, they have a German joke.
Yeah, does Terry Goodkind not understand he's part of that great fantasy tradition of you know, gripping story, but horrible cover art. And do you remember that one that we did a while ago, guys, where the actual, one of the characters was presented on the cover as being the wrong race?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's probably a lot more than one fantasy novel.
Yeah, and let's not forget, you know, during the 70s and 80s, how many muscled heroes had scantily clad beauties staring up at them while gripping their legs?
And the book covers were terrible as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're just talking about the editors and publishers there.
I mean, in case listeners, you were confused as to how seriously we should take Terry Goodkind or Goodkind, and the fact that I haven't learned how to say his name is not tipping you off.
Terry Goodkind, more like Terry Bad Mean, am I right? Bam! Got him!
Owned.
Do you remember I reviewed The Pagan Knight a while ago?
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah, that did not have good cover art.
No, they didn't. I mean, it's basically a guy with a sword going, "Roar!"
I'm going to Google this now you've said that.
And the thing is, I actually interviewed the author of The Pagan Knight, Tim Akers. He's a lovely, lovely fella. But I did ask him about that cover art, and he's like, yeah, it's a bit odd, isn't it? It's like the most generic fantasy.
I've just Googled this, and yeah, that's not good.
Yeah.
I think there's a big difference between saying, yeah, it's a bit odd, isn't it, to let's start a whole Twitter campaign over slagging off this artist.
The thing is, I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, this is still better than that cover art for The Pagan Knight, because The Pagan Knight was just some dude with a sword shouting.
Yes.
This actually has some kind of, you know, it's got a couple of characters in the background. It's got a female character with a sword, which, you know, is empowering, you know? It's got some statues, I'm assuming, or maybe these are soldiers who've been turned to stone. I don't know.
It's intriguing, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a story there. There seems to be some kind of citadel or something in the background. So there are lots of things in this picture that hint at, there's a story here. Maybe I should read this book.
But if you were wondering whether you should read a Terry Goodkind book, the following extract from his previous novel, Soul of the Fire, has been doing the rounds on Twitter since this controversy. And it's worth reading in full. I found it on Tumblr for, I'm not quite sure who this is, but the writer adds, maybe I should add that Goodkind does not have an ironic bone in his body. Everything he says he means in the most serious way possible. So here it is. Hissing. Hackles lifting. The chicken's head rose. Callan pulled back. Its claws digging into stiff dead flesh, the chicken slowly turned to face her. It cocked its head, making its comb flop, its wattles sway. Shoo! Calla heard herself whisper. There wasn't enough light, and besides, the side of its beak was covered with gore, so she couldn't tell if it had the dark spot, but she didn't need to see it. Dear spirits, help me, she prayed under her breath. The bird let out a slow chicken cackle. It sounded But in her heart, she knew it wasn't. In that instant, she completely understood the concept of a chicken that was not a chicken. This looked like a chicken, like most of the mud people's chickens. But this was no chicken. This was evil manifest.
What?
If you're writing an evil chicken, you should not double down and then use the word chicken at least three times in every sentence.
A chicken cackled. Who did say cackling?
I like that just when you think he might be about to let you forget that this thing is just a chicken, he keeps on adding stuff like, make no mistake, it definitely looked like a chicken, and it sounded like a chicken, and it had wattle, and the way it walked was a bit chickeny, but it was not a chicken.
Okay, so
it still looked exactly like a chicken.
My question is, if this was a trading card game and someone played that, could you counter it by playing, say, Voodoo Priest?
You could counter it by KFC.
Actually, yeah, the Colonel.
That being said, I think it's highly appropriate that Terry Goodkin spent many paragraphs talking about nothing but an awful cock.
And I think that's done it for me.
Do you know, when you guys were talking, I found some pretty bad fantasy novel covers.
Right.
Fantasy and science fiction. But there's one that, see, I used to be a fan of this classic sci-fi series, right? This classic sci-fi franchise. Whereas until I saw this particular image. Now, I'm not sure how to describe this image, so I'm just gonna share it with the two of you. So,
okay. Right, so you realize this bit isn't gonna go well if none of us can describe the image.
Don't worry, you'll be able to describe it. Have a look at that and tell me what you think is going on here.
So Rob has shared E.E. Doc Smith's Children of the Lens of the famous Lensman 6 series, which apparently involves a man with three breasts and circled by a cult of rainbow women while he does a dance move from fame.
It's not the Lensman 6 series. That's actually book 6 in the Lensman series. Yeah,
there is a close
that's just not well laid
up
out
of his face in the background too, in which he seems to be very excited to be around these lovely young ladies. Oh, and also it's covered in like fake lens flare. Seriously, J.J. Abrams would look at this and say, it's too much, tone it down.
Yep.
It's not even flaring off of anything.
No, it's just sparkle.
Here's another one for you guys. Just for you guys. This is the same book, but two very different covers for this.
Where's that angel sexing Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz?
Because somewhere her future lies buried.
That is some amazing Fabio hair the angel has got, though.
Yeah. And not just Fabio hair. I mean, how can the same story have two so very different covers?
Yes.
This is Helm's Wave by Colin Greenland, for those of you playing at home.
But the one on the left does not have any angels. It's got ships.
Yeah.
It's got plenty of ships. No angels, though.
Well, actually, no. The ship closest to the view, a guy with sort of dark wings.
Ah, yeah, true. But
He isn't bare-chested and about to envelop a woman who looks kind of half-swooning, half a bit cautious, like half, look, this is getting a bit too heavy for me.
The one on the right looks like some weird fantasy Mills and Boone.
Yes.
I think she's just distracted by his hair. Yeah. I am.
She's going to wake up the next morning and go, oh my God, he's got wings. How did I not see that?
Hang on, he's saying it's going to be like John Travolta in that film, Michael.
Yes. Also, something I've just noticed about this, not only does he have wings, but the wings are actually replacing his arms. It's not like standard fantasy angels where they are humans, but they have wings folding from their back.
Oh, yeah. His arms are like going into the wing.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think I like that.
No, that's freaky.
Sorry, I couldn't resist sharing a couple of those. Anyway. Last news story, because we do have a book that we want to do as well. Yeah. This one's very, 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 very quick. The chief executive of Hachette Livre, Arnaud Nourri, has been speaking to various Indian news sites, one in particular called Scroll, and he did a wide-ranging interview in which he explained why ebooks have reached a plateau, or rather a slight decline. And I'm just going to quote directly what he said about ebooks. It's the limit of the ebook format. The ebook is a stupid product. It is exactly the same as print, except it's electronic. There is no creativity, no enhancement, no real digital experience.
I think, to risk sincerity for a moment, he has a point in that part of what I find objectionable about ebooks is that they have been designed not to be a new thing, but to replace print. And that has limited what they can do as an artistic medium.
Yeah, I will grant that. My main objection is that if I sit on an ebook, I'll probably break it, whereas if I sit on a book, you know, because as we've already established, I am large.
Reading... Also, I think Graham put it much more eloquently than ebooks are stupid and dumb and they're poopy heads and I hate them.
Exactly. Ebooks are stupid. That's some great logic there.
Shall we use this to segue into my review?
Yes.
Sure, sure. I mean, I can think about Angel Man some more. Something the feathers are like his fingers.
His fingers just sort of grow into the bones like birds. He has fingers that are longer than his torso.
Oh, I don't like that at all.
Hang on. Does that mean his fingers are basically just covered in finger longerers that have been flattened out? Then?
This Angel Man isn't sexy at all.
No, his lovely hair has deceived us.
Hang on.
That's it. The lovely hair's just there so you don't think about his weird feathery fingers.
Oh my god, what if this angel is kind of the terrifying offspring of an incubus and a harpy?
You've just guessed the twist.
Yeah, so he's basically a harpy from, like, you know, the wings and the, you know, the waist down. But he has the looks of an incubus, so he's attractive to all women.
God.
And you know, bi and curious and gay men. Let's be fair.
Oh, that's just opening up an entire terrifying world of downstairs possibilities. Graham, quick talk about your book.
Yes, let's get on to the book. So the book is Spare and Found Parts, which is a debut novel by Sarah Marie Griffin. And I wanted to sort of talk about it after we've established scientifically that ebooks are stupid and they're bad and dumb. Because I realised we've never talked about the book we review as a physical object before, but this is a really beautiful book. The pages are sort of lined with this red trim. It has a very lovely embossed cover, which is very sort of detailed and full of gold filigree work. Even the typeset that it's in is very lovely. It's hot on serifs, and I think, listeners, we established last week, I too am hot on serifs.
Not making any jokes about Arab Ben.
I left a little gap because I had to jump in there, but I'm pleased that you resisted the temptation.
Yeah, we're a classy show. It's feathery as well.
It's a good thing I didn't show him the cover of A Scanner Darkly.
Yes. So this is Spare and Found Parts, a science fiction novel and also a coming-of-age novel, which is set in a future version of Ireland. I have to say, I was some way into it, but I worked out it was meant to be set in Ireland, and I did love that it is not set in the usual science fiction locales. It is not either on mainland Britain or in America. I appreciated that.
That's great, actually.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it treats that subtly but distinctively. And it's the story of Nell Crane, who is the daughter of a great inventor, and her deceased mother is also a very prominent figure who's work of creating an enormous statue to rally people round in these rather dark dystopian environments is a constant source of status anxiety for Nell. I mean, there's been a lot of books written about being in the shadow of an older sibling, but Nell is literally in her older sibling's shadow because the last thing her mother created is this enormous statue that towers over her house. So that's quite fun. And the world that she lives in, I don't want to explain too much about it because it's unfolded very carefully, piece by piece. But the world she lives in is very anti-technology. There's been a dreadful plague, and a lot of people have only survived by having artificial parts put in them. Nell herself has an artificial heart. But because this world is very technophobic, the artificial parts are generally made from old-fashioned gears and cogs. So there's a continual device that when Nell's heart rate rises, it actually literally causes this sort of loud ticking to her ears. It's quite a nice device, which I think Griffin goes back to slightly too many times, but it's a good idea, you know. And the book is full of little. There's a bit where Nell and her friend and on-off love interest Oliver find a load of glass eyes in an abandoned hospital. And that's quite an exciting discovery because they realise they can sell them to people who have lost an eye but who distrust technology. So there's these little pieces of ingenuity around it. While I was reading it, I was sort of occupied by the question of who is this book aimed at? Because it's, you know, Griffin is quite a sophisticated writer. The book is about sort of 400 pages long. It has occasional chapters that are written in second person, which is always an exciting thing to pull off, but it reads as very literary, you know.
All right.
I'm using them fancy big boy book words.
Because I've read this, you see. It's increased my word talking things.
Did you lose weight as well?
I did, and I stopped committing crimes. But there's also this aspect of it which reads quite like a young adult novel, and sometimes in positive ways. You know, I think if I was like a young girl and I was reading about Nell Crane, I would find her very empowering as she rushes to sort of fix her life and get out of the shadow of her parents. But sometimes it feels young adult in slightly generic ways. It resolves itself as this triangle between Nell and Oliver and the boy that Nell builds. It becomes her project to make a companion for herself, and it's kind of a sort of Pygmalion myth in that way. And it's kind of interesting, but it's let down by the fact that the love triangle is the kind of sort of the crutch of young adult literature. You know, ever since Twilight, every young adult novel has to be about a love triangle.
Yeah, it's very, we have to take down the government and save people from the oppressive regime, but also, which of these hunky boys do I choose?
Yes.
See, I think that's one of the reasons why something like Warm Bodies was a little bit of a break from the norm, because there wasn't really a love triangle in that, was there?
Yeah. And I think, you know, even with something like The Hunger Games, which starts off as a love triangle, and you can just sort of feel Suzanne Collins starting to care less and less, it feels like an imposition. And I also felt, and this is quite damaging to the book, that Nell herself is kind of a cipher. And it's like, if this is aimed at young adults, I can see the value of that, in that it, you know, a lot of young adult novels and a lot of children's novels too. I mean, a lot of the Roald Dahl novels I grew up with, like George's Marvelous Medicine, have a fairly blank central character that the reader can then put themselves in the shoes of.
Yeah.
But I don't think it is. The further I got with it, the more I felt that the slightly sort of not passive, she does a lot, but slightly off the peg characterization of Nell was an active flaw. And it's only really once you're about 250 pages in that Io gets switched on. We have some discoveries about Nell's past and her parents. And generally, the sort of plot starts to get into motion. Before then, it's become a sort of combined character study of people around her and an exploration of family life in this dystopian world. And it feels like Griffin was about 250 pages in before she realised, if I keep unfolding things at this pace, this is going to lap warm and peace. I'd like Io, give it a jolt of electricity to get it started. But there are, as I say, despite thinking that the structure of the book is flawed and that it, you know, it might have made a better film in that at least then you would have an actress playing Nell who could, you know, imbue her with some sort of greater personality and some of the pacing could be sorted out. I do think Griffin is an interesting writer, and there's some lovely sort of rhetorical stuff where you can see a bit of the passion that comes from her previous work writing about the world we live in come through. There's a bit where Nell's father has sort of a talk with his daughter about the world they live in, and he says, "They burned the clever machines out of the world, but before the turn, doctors and scientists had just about discovered how to make things like this. That's why the first toxic pulses went out. People loved their clever machines too much. If a machine can give you an answer, what use is prayer? If you can host a revolution online, what use is government? If information is free, how do you keep people under control? All this is penance for the coding. An era of silence after the information age, the age that could have defeated any god." I think that's lovely.
That is very, very nice, actually.
Mm. But elsewhere, and I have to say this, and I hate to bring this to a negative conclusion, but this is very important. Elsewhere, she says that Hunky Dory by David Bowie came out in 1974. 3 years out, Griffin! I could have excused this as saying it's a post sort of technology, post internet age, they can't check, but it's Io saying this. He's a machine. He should be right. How can I trust a dystopian author who doesn't even know the basic facts of David Bowie's career?
But what if that was the point, that you meant to question Io's motivations?
Yes. What if Io's the kind of Dilbert who thinks that Pinups is Bowie's best 70s album?
Hang on, what if that's how you tell if he's lying? What if this Pinocchio, his nose doesn't get longer?
This what now?
Pinocchio.
Oh, okay, thank goodness. I thought you were just really weirdly pronouncing Pinocchio.
But what if his nose...
Okay, I get it, I'm on the page now. Yeah.
What if his nose didn't get longer? He just gets facts about Bowie wrong.
Maybe that's it. I bet he thinks Let's Dance was a really consistent album that definitely wasn't skating along on the strength of its singles.
Or it's a grim indictment of how even with all this technology at our fingertips, we're not necessarily any smarter or more right than we are when just relying on simple paper and pen books.
Maybe that's it, yes. Because yeah, that's one of the benefits of living near a library, is that crime goes down, people get thinner, and people stop getting basic facts about David Bowie wrong.
On a slightly more serious, less Bowie-related note, the way you've been describing this book, and this is going to sound a little bit odd, but just the whole way you described it, I was getting real kind of echoes of things like Battle Angel Alita. From it.
Right. As a non-anime fan, I'll say...
It's basically when you were talking about even a heart is like a clockwork heart type thing. And that's a very big thing in the world of Battle Angel Alita, on the, you know, in the place where she starts off where she lives, a lot of people have replacement parts like that. They have mechanical parts. They have, you know, robotic parts. And the
is there also a line about Nell having gigantic eyes that can definitely see your soul and know when you're going to die?
No, if there was, I definitely missed that bit.
Probably not Battle Angel Alita then.
Yeah, I'm just saying I'm getting kind of echoes of it. I'm not saying that there's any solid tie. I'm just saying that I can envision that something like Battle Angel Alita may have given her some inspiration into the world itself rather than just, you know.
Mm.
And maybe some inspiration into the character of Nell herself, because there are similarities between the two characters as well.
I kept, in terms of film, I kept getting echoes of Tim Burton, but good Tim Burton, I hasten to add, not Alice in Wonderland Tim Burton.
So I think we might need to look into our mics if we're getting echoes of both Battle Angel Alita and Tim Burton. That was like a proper joke.
That was
good.
So do you recommend this then?
I would, with caveats. I think if you're the sort of reader who enjoys in the shoes of the lead character rather than observing a lead character, Nell's characterization probably won't bother you as much as it does me. And as I say, it is full of good ideas. And she's a Daft Punk fan, I learned while reading this, so she's always got that on her side. I had problems with it. I still think it could probably make a pretty terrific movie, but it is interesting, and it is set in an original kind of world.
Okay, cool.
It's probably one of the more split recommendations I have issued while on this show, but the book left me feeling pretty divided.
That's fair enough. I mean, we can't have winners all of the time, but we can't have losers all of the time either.
Yeah. And the cover is lovely. It is a lovely looking book. I want to stress that again. It's lovely to see that people are still actually making time and putting effort into getting a book looking good as a thing that you can put on your shelf.
Yeah. Well, not only that, as a thing that if you were walking around or sitting at a cafe reading that, people yes. would be looking over out the corner of their eye. They'd be trying to see what you're reading.
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, you don't get that with an ebook.
No, not at all. They're stupid, I hear.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Ah, right, so that's us for this week then. So all of our previous shows are available on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. We've got a Patreon, which is on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk. So if you are enjoying the comedy value that we have to offer, then, you know, give us some support.
Mm.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or email us studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. Until the next time, when we'll have more of whatever this has been. Yes, more of
I mean,
whatever.
Do you think he has like weird chicken legs as well?
I'm going to move back to the chicken again, the chicken cackling.
I think he's...
God, is that what happens when he finishes?
On that note, until the next episode, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Graham.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening, you poor unfortunate souls.